I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey Brad, you know what I've been doing today?
Running down the beach with weights on your feet?
No. Stuck on YouTube watching you play music in the 90s. I recommend anyone listening to the program right now that they go ahead and Google the Goops, some of their videos, especially this one show at the Wetlands in like 95. Brad over here, platinum blonde, Billy Idol hair. He's got some kind of like pink silky shirt buttoned all the way down to here. We got like full rock and roll chest out. You got sharp pants with like a white line down them.
So
you got moves. You're working the stage.
Oh,
you're all over
pants.
The place. Oh my goodness. You were something else.
You know what? I think that Wetland show was actually our record. We had like a 2-part record release party.
Okay.
And we played a show there, and then we went over to Don Hill's and did like a late after party.
All I remember from the Wetlands in those days is like hippie jam bands, like the Disco Biscuits and shit like that, doing those all night things. And then like those 16 and up shows they did on the weekends, those hardcore shows. I came in one time to see Endpoint and Falling Forward at the Wetlands, and I was like 15, and I'm at the door. And they're like, it's 16 up to get in. I looked like I was 11. So, but I was sitting there arguing with the guy. I'm like, yeah, I'm 16. He's like, prove it. I'm like, I'm from New Jersey. I couldn't fucking prove it to you anyway. You don't get a fucking 16-year-old ID. What is this random shit you guys are doing here, you know? That was a fun place, though. I also once
It was mostly hippie bands. But, now and then they'd have a hardcore show. I remember seeing, like, Murphy's Law there and, like, But, you know, that story, there's a second part to that. Was that like when we went to Don Hill's for the second part of our record release party, which was supposed to start at like midnight or something. Like you didn't go there before, you know, midnight anyway.
Right.
But Ian Astbury, the singer of The Cult.
Yeah.
Was on stage. He was doing a show with his solo band and he wouldn't get the fuck off the stage. Like he had gone, they were supposed to be off already. They'd either, I don't know whether they'd gone on late or whatever, but like, and this is testament to Don Hill, RIP. God bless him. I love that man.
Yeah,
he kicked him off.
He did. Wow.
Yeah. He finally said like, guys, you got to get off the stage.
That's gangster.
And there was like people there. There was people there to see him. I think it was like a secret show. Maybe it was like a label show or something, but there was still like, there was probably, you know, 150, 200 people there.
True New Yorkers give no fucks.
Don Hill,
no
man.
Fucks.
I love Don.
We even talked about it in that interview we just did. Those classic old New York City bars from the 80s and 90s that the punks could get down at. Those were some wild places, man. Your Manitobas. And when did Niagara open? In the 90s?
Niagara opened, I think, in 98. I think 98.
Yeah. And you were still just young and platinum blonde and handsome when this was all going on. Were you just ripping around the city at that point?
Well, I was playing with Johnny, one of the owners.
Oh.
He had a band called Clowns for Progress that like...
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
They had worn clown makeup, and then the band kind of broke up, and they wanted me to join. I was like, I'll do it, but I can't wear clown makeup. And we did some good... We were like one of those bands that was like every band's favorite band, you know? Like, bands would love to take us on tour because we were just like a party band. So like right, we toured right. with like the Boss Tones and with like we did Warped Tour just like a week or something with Warped Tour. Lagwagon took us out. That was when we did the shows with All. Was with the Lagwagon,
right.
Lagwagon Tour.
Now tell me a little bit about this style I was looking at. Like what? Who were you emulating? Like what was your? What were you going for?
So here's what I loved about New York in the 90s. Was that,
again, anyone listening, please Google the Goops at the Wetlands in 1996. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
You know what I loved about New York was like there wasn't, outside of hardcore, there wasn't really a scene. Like there was a collective of bands that we all like played together and we all loved each other, like D-Gen, you know, Jesse's band.
There wasn't like a punk scene.
Yeah, there wasn't even like a real collective. Like we all kind of played the same venues and we would go to each other's shows, but there wasn't like a real unifying thing. But except that a lot of the bands kind of, and I think this is a New York thing, kind of really liked glam, you know? So we had like Space Hog and D-Gen were fully kind of a glam, like rock band.
Sure, sure.
And we definitely, I was into it, man. I was like, you know, I was a old punk rocker, but I couldn't get with the old ripped t-shirt look, even though that was exploding all over again at that point.
Right.
So I dressed it up a little bit.
A little bit.
Well, that was our record release. I was a little flashier there.
No, I respect it, man. I've been like basically painfully underdressed my entire life. And one thing I have realized is, you know, if you asked me when I was younger, I would have been like, you know, I want to be judged for the merit of my work. You know what I mean? For what I'm putting out there, for my character, for things like this. And, you know, I didn't quickly learn, but learned eventually that all these things that people I deemed corny sometimes, in all honesty, were doing, were like not only totally necessary, but also part of like a part of the thread I didn't really consider until I got older. Maybe until I met my wife, because she's so into fashion. And the thing I think I didn't understand about punk fashion was the not only the iconography, but like the statement you were actually making, you know, by putting on those things,
right,
by being a little more effeminate, by being, you know, in those days especially, it was making a statement, and it was part of the culture. I guess I was a little naive in the idea that I thought you were just completely, you know, recognized on the kind of the output of your work and what people were seeing and how they were receiving it wasn't nearly as important. And in reality, the people who present it a certain way and are actually really good to boot are the ones who put themselves in the best position.
But speaking of that, we were kind of in a way not rebelling against, but pushing ourselves apart from the West Coast bands. Even though like the Goops ended up doing tons of tours with all, I mean, we pretty much toured with all West Coast bands, but you know, that was back when everybody was just wearing shorts and baggy t-shirts.
Yeah, sure. No, it's definitely New York. Very New York. Well, you look great. So anyway, we had Ben Wyman on. The great Ben Wyman we had on for this interview. Somebody who did not harness a glam style through his career in the least.
Not at all.
But also used other powers of persuasion to make him the most punk rock guy ever. So something I didn't talk about this in the interview because I thought it would, you know, allude to some nepotism or something like that, is the fact that for all these years, most of the news I ever got about Ben Wyman came from my Aunt Judy. And that's a pretty random connection. My Judith Kaufman, my aunt, is a doctor in psychology, and she is one of the department heads or the department head at Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. And it turns out, dating all the way back to, I believe, like the 80s, she's been colleagues with Ben Wyman's dad, who has been an academic and a teacher and then also, you know, like the head of the humanities department and things like this. You know, real higher up. And now I even think he's a dean of one of the schools. And, you know, my aunt was also, a higher up academic at this college, and they knew each other for a long time. And the funny part about that is, you know, I knew Ben from around the way, but he was from the Morristown area. It was about an hour north from me. And if, you know, we weren't at a show or something, you know, I didn't see him that much. We didn't keep in regular touch. But I liked Dillinger. I always followed him. But most of the news I would ever get from Ben would be on the phone with my Aunt Judy being like, did you hear that Ben Wyman broke his collarbone in Austria? Did you hear that Ben Wyman dropped the guitar on his foot and did this? This, I'm like, nah, Aunt Judy, I didn't hear that. Like, what are you talking to his dad again? She's like, yeah. So for years and years, I would kind of get these updates from Ben from his dad via my aunt. And then, you know, once Gaslight started kind of hitting the festival circuit and stuff, that's when, you know, we wound up playing with Dillinger Escape Plan and kind of winding up in the same world. Even though I knew him from New Jersey,
that's pretty hilarious. You know,
we didn't know each other that intimately, you know, through music. So, you know, we've reconnected later in life, like through the years. And I think that's almost part of the reason is, you know, we had this bizarre family connection the whole time. So FDU represent, and big ups to my Aunt Judy. Actually, she's part of the concept for some bonus content that I've been thinking about doing because she's a funny lady.
Let's get her on, man.
Let's get her on. This Ben interview is fun because I always feel like Ben just has a very unique perspective on things. He's like, you know, even though he doesn't play punk rock, that dude is fucking punk rock. You know, it's like if 100 people are doing one thing, he wants to find another way to do it. And I completely respect it musically and business-wise. And I think he has a lot of interesting things to say. And I think there's a lot of, you know, lessons to be learned for people on how to kind of maybe flow with life a little bit. You know, telling us his story about how he picked up that animal sanctuary and just kind of rolled with it and let life kind of determine it for him without putting up any roadblocks. It's a good lesson to keep, you know.
Go with the flow, man.
Go with the flow. So I'm sure it took a lot of practice for a Jewish guy from North Jersey to learn how to go with the flow because, you know, we're a little neurotic sometimes. But I think that was a great lesson to take from what Ben said. And I think that's what we start this interview with. So let's get into it. Let's talk about the animals.
You know what? I still have the carcass of your Christmas tree.
What?
I still have the carcass of your Hanukkah bush. You know, hanging out back of the animals. I can't bear to throw it out, so they just kind of scrape their, use it as like a scraper scratcher.
Wait, so they chomped all the pine needles off and then just left the
rest?
Oh,
it's been long gone. It was gone in like a day, and now they just kind of like rub against it and get sexy with it.
Oh, I'm so happy that I'm part of the natural circle of life on the farm.
Absolutely.
Well, you're getting another one next year.
Oh, cool.
So
very good.
For some context, anyone tuning in, Brad, you there?
Yeah, dude.
Are we on the air?
I've been recording since Benny came on, yeah.
Yeah, that's how we go, Ben.
Gotcha.
We just dig right in. We think it's fun.
This is how we do it.
Yeah. So for some context, I had seen, you know, I knew, we'll talk about it further in the interview, but I knew that Ben had an animal sanctuary and was doing that work. And he made a post showing his animals, mostly the goats, digging into a Christmas tree. And, you know, I like begrudgingly have been doing Christmas for years. I like Santa Claus. I like presents. I even like trees. You know what I mean? But like, there is still some Jewish guilt about getting into it.
Of course. I'm in the same boat. You know?
Yeah. And as much as I like to embrace it, there's still that, like, you know, I imagine some old people in a shtetl somewhere just being like, what the fuck are you doing, man?
Our people died for this rite.
Yeah,
to freedom of religion. And
yeah,
now
not even that long ago, pal.
And then all it takes is some vagina and a few kids to ruin all of it.
That's it. Move to this capitalist enterprise, eat some McDonald's, have sex, and all of a sudden you're not Jewish anymore.
All of a sudden you got Santa Claus coming to town.
So, but one of the things that bums me out the most always is like, I just hate cutting down a tree and letting it rot and die in your house. It just feels strange and anticlimactic. Yeah. And every time I throw it out, I'm like, well, that was a bummer. That was like a perfectly healthy young tree I just murdered to, you know, dress it up for a couple months and you know, and then put it outside. And then I imagine the millions and millions of trees that that's done to. So when I saw Ben feeding the pine needles in the tree, I hit you up immediately and was like, hey, could take a family trip down to the farm and feed the tree. So I cut it into many pieces, threw it in the back of my dad's car, shoved the kids in, and came to Ben's Animal Sanctuary and fed it to the goats.
There you have it.
I enjoyed my day greatly.
Very good.
It's a lovely – and you should know, that day out there in the country has helped us. You know, we might be coming out to the country soon. I might be your neighbor before you know it.
You know what? The house next door is for sale. It's going for sale.
Wait, the one with your wacky neighbor?
Yes, which bums me out so much.
Yeah, she's a real trip.
She is. She's leaving in August.
What was the story with her? You moved in and she just kind of came with the property, right?
Well, it was funny because when we first saw the house, my wife is just like, this is it, I want it. And I'm like, you know, like in front of the real estate agent. And I'm like, shh, you know, like, hey, not so quick. So I immediately had to start coming up with negatives in order to counter the obvious excitement, you know, before even trying to, you know, negotiate anything.
Yeah.
And I said, well, there's a house. It's like right on top of us. Like, I don't really want to live that close to a neighbor. You don't get this many acres to have to like stare at somebody and they're going to be annoying and looking at us and whatever.
It's true.
Which was true, you know?
Yeah.
At any rate, we moved in and it ended up being this lovely lesbian couple, ex-bikers, rock and roll singers, who run a cat sanctuary. Vegetarian, like... in the middle of, like, you know, the most conservative farmy area in New Jersey.
Yeah.
It's pretty much like this, you know, half our street is the property of these two houses, which are like the most crazy, wackiest people probably in the entire town, you know.
It's pretty serendipitous that you found you found some, you know, because as you say, you know, I know that area. Like, there's a good chance you might wind up next to someone with – let's just say a different set of morality.
Yeah. I mean, look, I hear guns going off every day. There's hunting everywhere. I've got like deer towers on my lawn and shit that I've had to like say no. You know, I don't care who used to live here. Like, you can't hunt here on my backyard anymore.
Right.
Like,
yeah. Not allowed.
And then like our neighbor happens to be someone who literally feeds a fox for 15 years. Because the old owner of my house shot the husband of the – like the foxes are monogamous, you know. So she shot the fox and they got in a big fight over it. And then ever since, my neighbor's been feeding this fox who was afraid to leave the den to babies to hunt. It was a widow fox named Fiona. So now Fiona comes every day and gets like chicken. Raw chicken, and it keeps her from eating my chickens, you know. Which is, first I was like, you're out of your mind. Like, there's no way like giving this thing a taste for chicken is gonna stop it from eating chicken. Like, it just, but it works. Like, she's like, I get my meal every day, I don't need to eat your chicken. So, but there's a million other foxes that'll do that in the area. But so now she's gonna leave and Fiona's gonna be starving and I'm going to get some asshole next to me, and it's all messed up.
Benny, so, it's your opportunity, Benny,
dude. I think this is your opportunity to come in and
And the only prerequisite is that I just have to feed a fox, a widowed fox?
You do, but they said they'd come and drop chicken off, because I was like,
oh.
They'll actually drop the chicken off. What I was thinking was going to butchers and seeing, like, you know how they throw out all the, like, organs and stuff?
Yeah, just the butchers parts.
Yeah, and that's the best parts for animals, like the livers and all. That's the most nutritious. So maybe I can just get a whole bunch of that stuff.
You might even be able to get chickens, because the expiration on a chicken is not going to affect a fox one bit.
That's a good point. Give me your old-ass chickens.
Yeah.
Give me all your old-ass. Did you have a lot of moments like that where, you know, I know you didn't really have a background with this and basically moved into a house with animals and decided to adopt them and take them on. Have you had like a lot of moments like that where you've sort of kind of realized not like the brutality of the animal kingdom, but just how like things actually work with animals and like what you have to do to manage them? It's not always pretty, right?
No, and I've certainly, I think we all kind of project our human nature onto animals. You know, we always want, and you know, Disney hasn't helped that. It's like, yeah, you know, true. We grew up with animals wearing outfits and like hanging out and talking and being like, you know, we want our dogs. We talk to our dogs like little children, and we want them to act like people, and we want them to know all this stuff. But like, there's no better lesson in the fact that animals are not people than having a farm,
right?
Like, you know, and being in a rural area. I guess a couple times, like, well, for one, some people probably saw in my Instagram, like a ram.
Yeah.
Beating the crap out of me. And
I remember us managing our best to try to keep the children away from that one.
Right, right. And the truth is, it's like, it doesn't want the children.
Right.
It thinks I'm a ram.
Okay.
You know, I raised that. That ram was born 2 weeks into me moving in the house.
Okay.
Like, no idea about animals, no idea anything was even pregnant. I walked outside to like put water, and there was a birth sack with baby lamb sitting in front of me. And wow. I had no idea what I was like,
okay, yeah.
What do I do? And then like a bunch of others started plopping out, and I'm like, what the hell do I do with these things?
Okay.
But, you know, the fact is like, the more friendly you are with a ram, the more they know you, the worse, because they just think you're another ram. And that's just what they do, you know?
Right.
So, and I actually, that thing has like got me a whole bunch of times, like way worse than that video. And, you know, if they'll come back and do it again, you know, and the more, so like, you know, usually the best thing is to get a fence between you, or just turn around and kick, put your foot up, you know what I mean? Or kick or whatever. And so in the video, I do that. Like, he rams me. I'm totally like kind of like flustered, and I kick my foot out to avoid another hit. And of course, everyone on Instagram is like, real animal sanctuary, kicking an animal. I'm like, these fuckers enjoy it. It like releases hormones when they hit their heads and things. Like, they love it. Like, I've seen this thing ram a freaking like brick wall like 7 times just because it's bored. You know? Trust me, I'm not abusing the animal. I'm just trying to not get my spine dislocated, you know?
Yeah. He took you out. When you went to the house, how many actual animals were still left on the property by the previous owner?
Well, the previous owner, who's a nice lady, you know, her daughter was going away to college. I think, you know, the husband that she initially bought the house with and bought a lot of the animals with, they were divorced, and she was getting older and had some health issues and stuff. So the animals just at that point weren't in great shape. I'm not passing judgment, you know. Sure. I don't know, you know, I'm sure.
As you said, difficult to take care of,
Yeah, of course. But the place wasn't in great shape. The animals were in great shape, but I didn't know anything about them. As far as I could tell, that was normal, you know? Mm-hmm. These were animals. Everything was how it normally should be.
Right.
And then she asked if she can leave the animals there for a little bit while she got her new place sorted, because she had a new place with a barn, but it wasn't ready, you know?
Okay.
And she's like, well, you know, I'll come and you know, we'll take care of them. We'll stop by, feed them, do all the stuff. But if you can, and so our real estate lawyer's like, absolutely not. That's a liability, this, that. And me and my wife were like, absolutely yes. You know, like that sounds cool. Like, we can learn about animals. We get to see, watch them. They're cool.
And you're like, getting sued, whatever.
Whatever, I'm used to that. Yeah. But like, you know, our whole thing was maybe we'll learn something and the kids get to see it, and then maybe we'll get some chickens and a goat or two one day, you know?
Right. So had you had any experience with animals prior to this, like farm animals?
No.
No.
I didn't even have a dog growing up. I didn't even have a dog
growing up. Shit.
So what in your head?
Benny, you know what I had? I had a goldfish from the Porm Carnival. That's what I had.
Perm fish. All right. Oh, that's fucking hilarious.
So she left these animals and I guess what, never came back for them?
So what happened was like 1 week turned to 2 weeks, 2 weeks turned to 3 weeks, 3 weeks turned to 4 weeks. And I guess to make a long story short, it just started becoming a source of anxiety for me because I just didn't really know if she was coming, if they were being taken care of, what I should be doing, what I shouldn't be doing. I started just going out there and doing what I can. Then I started cleaning up. Then I started saying, oh, some of these animals have health issues. And then,
but did she leave any instructions like what to feed them or when? I mean, that's,
I watched, I'd go out there and be like, hey, what's going on? And I'd see what's up. And her boyfriend would come by and kind of do it, but he wasn't that into it. You know, I think he just did it.
Right.
And then, I kind of like at some point I was just like, look, you're not really taking these animals anytime soon, if ever. They're happy here. I feel like I just need to know if they're my responsibility or not. And she's like, all right, well, I guess we'll just leave them here. And I'm like, you know what? I'd rather just accept. I'd rather just make that definitive know that I have to dive in. Sure. And she took a few. Like, she came by with a truck and took like a few of the ones she really liked, which were interesting because they weren't really – necessarily like friendly ones. It was like, oh, here, I want this goat that doesn't go anywhere near anyone, or the sheep that's just like weird. But and the rest she left, and I was like, all right, I'm a farmer, it's that simple.
how did that work in conjunction with, like, you know, I know you're in a similar boat as me where you kind of went into, you know, kids and house and things like that. It's kind of the same time, you know, Dillinger was slowing down.
Right.
Do you think if you were in like a full-time touring schedule that you even would have been buying a house or willing to take that on, or did the style of life at the time kind of allow it?
Well, no, I don't. I mean, I really, like, technically I was like single and childless when the decision to end Dillinger came about.
Okay.
So, I didn't really have any other form of job. I wasn't really in another band. I had some side project stuff, but like the decision to end Dillinger was completely, you know, just diving in head first with no idea what was going to happen. There was no plan. So some people feel like, oh, look, he's gotten married. He has kids. Sure, right. He's got a farm. So he stopped the band, but it was actually
on paper. Yeah, sure. On paper. Yeah. It's seen that way. Yeah.
But actually, it was like all those doors opened as soon as I stopped the band, you know? So, yeah, I mean, like, I met my wife. Things moved really quickly. She had a son from a previous marriage. I really became close with him. We got pregnant. I had already, you know, the band was in its last few months of final tour type of thing. And everything lined up. It was like, within like 3 days of ending the band, we moved into a new home, acquired 80 farm animals. I had two kids and a marriage.
You said 80?
About 80 with birds. Yeah.
You're right.
I was thinking you were talking about like a goat and two chickens.
It was about 75, 80 animals or something. Yeah.
So what?
That's pretty serious over there, man. Horses, alpacas.
Really?
Yeah. Well, we've gotten a lot more. I mean, so we've.
So what was the original? Just tell me the original lineup when you as like this metal guitar player who'd never even had a dog. What did you originally inherit from this lady?
A whole bunch of goats, a bunch of sheep, and then like a bunch of baby sheep were born literally 2 weeks into moving in.
Okay.
Just dropped, you know, just like sitting there. Turkeys, ducks, chickens, a goose that we got rid of because it was attacking the kids. But when we got a new one now the other day, let's see, guinea hens, pigs, I think that's pretty much it. And then we rescued a bunch of horses, a mule, two alpacas, you know, more birds, a couple goats, couple
That's
pigs,
a lot of work,
more pigs.
Man.
Yeah.
So I gotta tell us about. So when I went there, you had been sort of outfitting a prosthetic leg. for one of your ducks.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed in some of your posts that it seems to have taken pretty successfully. I was pretty taken aback by the fact that you were able to even find someone who did that and get into it. Like, can you tell us what happened with that?
Well, I mean, this is actually a sad story, and I haven't told anyone really publicly yet. But the other day, Waddles the duck got taken by a fox.
Oh, no.
Or a hawk. I'm not sure.
Wow. Oh, I'm so sorry, man.
Yeah, it was tough. And the truth, the thing that was really hard about it was, you know, I raised it from a baby. We went through all that trouble. We got it a new leg. It was doing pretty well. The leg was a little long. We found in the grass and rough terrain, it wasn't doing as well as it did, you know, on a hard floor. Yeah. So I just got a new foot made. That was going to be like supercharged, bionic, kick-ass foot. That was, and literally the day before it was showing up, he was gone.
Fuck. So, and just from one of the wild animals, like around the property somewhere.
Yeah, and it's really tough because, you know, I definitely mourn every animal that gets hurt or killed or sick, and I'm getting better at it. You know, I mean, I'll never be the kind of farmer that can just like eat their bird, but
right.
You know, I mean, I certainly have gotten a little bit thicker skin, and like you said, I've learned a little bit about nature, and it just is. Sometimes it is what it is. You know, every time a baby bird dies, I don't give it a full funeral and bury it, and send out a Viking ship. I have to like deal with it a little more efficiently now.
So at first, were you like? You know, were you reading to each? Were you doing like a real kind of service?
Almost? Oh, dude! Every time, like something passed, like anytime I'd an animal, like you know, you get baby birds. Like some of them make it, some of them don't. Whatever, right. And like, you know, a little bird would die, and I'd be like depressed for a week, and I'd bury it and make a grave. Like it was ridiculous, you know, it was ridiculous. And my wife's a doctor, so I mean,
right.
She's had people she knows like die left and right. And I'm like, you know, I can't handle it like a chicken, you know? Sure. So,
well, actually kind of works perfectly into something I wanted to talk about. Cause you know, we're raising kids and you know, the things that you're doing and what your wife does are obviously going to give, whether they like it or not, they're going to have a bit of a sense of mortality. Like they're going to see death, you know, it's going to be part of their experience. The other day I got a press request, you know, there was a PR firm for like metal and hardcore bands.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking through the list. It's like, you know, 100 bands, maybe 400 faces. Mm-hmm. And I saw like three of them smiling.
Yeah. You
know? Like just hardcore metal press photos are the most depressing things. And even if it's some 19-year-old kid from like Randolph, New Jersey, he's still pretending to be hard in this photo.
For sure. And,
you know, like, so your kids, you know, they already have exposure to this.
Uh-huh.
Now, I walk around my house sometimes and I see some of the posters and I'm like, this is really like dark imagery.
Uh-huh.
This is like really dark content. And, you know, you're in like fully immersed in the metal world where like, basically what I'm asking is, are you concerned at all about like your kids and exposure to the culture of like metal and hardcore? And do you like censor it at all for them?
Man, that's a good question. You know, not really. Okay. Honestly, I don't, you know, the only thing I could say this, like, for the animal sanctuary, we kind of made a logo and some like an image for like a t-shirt and stuff. And it was pretty like satanic looking. It's like a goat head with like a pentagram around it. It's like the classic black metal kind of goat head thing. And it says Party Smasher Sanctuary and like black metal writing. And it's like fun, you know?
Sure.
But like, you know, of course there are people who are going to look at that like and think that we're satanic.
Yeah,
when I know it's just like a pun on metal, you know, it's like just like a metal thing, you know, it's like,
yes.
And you know, the question is how much do I care what these close-minded people think when they make judgment without actually knowing us? And how much do I, say, well, you know, it's cool as whatever. And then how much do I say, well, the truth is like the pentagram is pagan and it actually was in Christianity and it's actually tied to Satanism, like way later. And that it wasn't originally part of Satanism, but like, it's so fucking, you know what I mean? It's like,
once you can really get into the context. Yeah.
So, I mean, as far as like imagery and things like that with metal and association, I mean, I don't know, man. I listened to Deicide as a kid. Right. And, you know, the dude had like apparently had an upside down cross outside of his baby's nursery, like right in the window, and like had an upside down cross burned into his forehead.
Right.
And sang about Satan. And I, you know, like I never once ever, that never once affected me negatively. It was like watching a horror movie or like, you know what I mean? It was
sure. Just,
I don't know. So,
so not really.
I guess to answer your question, nah. I guess.
Yeah.
I had to think about it. I never thought about it.
Yeah.
I mean, your kids are just going to think you're a dork no matter what you do, right? So it doesn't matter. You're probably like
exactly
exposing to the darkest shit, and they're going to be the happiest people on earth, right? They're going to rebel against.
Oh, is that the okay? Totally. So overexposure to Slayer, get them a little Brujeria shirt with like like with a head just swinging on it. I love that. All right,
like you said, I'm gonna be a dork no matter what. My wife, who's like the Cornell Ivy League surgeon chick, is like way gnarlier than me. She partied way more than me. She like was in sororities and got gnarly and like still like, you know, likes to get wild and all this shit. And me, I'm the prude, boring one, you know? So
right.
I don't think any of that stuff really matters, you know, as long as you raise your kids right, you know? And, yeah, like you said, I think the more people try to shelter their kids, the more fucked up they end up, right? So
yeah, you got to be honest.
Yeah, what about you guys?
I mean, from the get-go, I just talked to my first kid as like, you know, a person. I think that's the most important thing, you know? We never talk baby talk.
Mm-hmm. Right, sure.
And like subjects, you know, I think some of the hard subjects have still to come up. But, you know, yeah, you got to be honest with them.
Mm.
And you got to show
just
love.
Lay it out.
It doesn't matter. I mean, everything, nothing else matters. Honesty and love, baby.
Yeah.
I mean, I do get a little concerned, honestly, with, and it's just because of how like empathetic and sensitive of a kid I was. And there was something, you know, that I could see or hear that would really ring with me and really stick with me for a long time. The one thing that scares me about it is like, you know, I'm not very religious. My parents weren't very religious. And sometimes when I think about it, I imagine that my father sort of intellectualized religion out of me a bit by being so open and honest about his own feeling. And my mom was sort of so in the middle and never really made up her mind.
Right.
But I feel like they almost like handed me their, you know, existential struggles and they just like gave them to me to continue. And the one thing I worry about with stuff like that is like, you know, I'm not pro-religion, anti-religion, stuff like that. But I want to give my kids like an open enough avenue to like have faith if they wanted to. You know what I mean? To, you know, basically to have all these, if I'm really believe in like a person setting their own course.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want them to be just like be a punk rock hardcore drummer just like me.
Right.
You know, I want those avenues open, and as much as I would I like a Slayer, and you know, even one of my, you know, the old Metallica, one of my favorite bands. Like, and I play that in front of my kids. My son pretends to be Eddie from Iron Maiden, like all the time, flying around.
Right.
I just told him he's a superhero. You know, but yeah, I wonder if too much of that, you know, negative imagery, or like if you just see something like that, if it's gonna, you know, basically change the course without you knowing it. That's kind of my concern, you know?
Right. I don't know. I mean, it's a really good question. You know, I'm in a similar boat where, you know, I grew up in a very conservative Jewish household with my dad in education. My parents were both in education. My dad was like an intellectual and always had professors and intellectuals over. And there's a lot of discussion. I mean, he even had friends who were like, Palestinian like professors who are very almost anti-Israel, you know, and they'd sit and have really intellectual conversations.
And both of your parents are practicing Jews?
They are, but, you know, well, my mom grew up in a household where she only spoke Yiddish at first. Like, her parents were, one was Russian, one was Polish, and the only thing they could do is speak Yiddish to each other. And then she only spoke Yiddish, and her aunts and uncles and that whole, they were all killed in the Holocaust. And so that she grew up with a lot of kind of survivor guilt stuff. Her mom really, really felt overprotective and guilt and all this stuff. So, like, you know, there was an element of, like we just joked about earlier, you know, like, people died for this right to just freedom of religion. And then my mom comes up and has to raise a family.
Yeah.
Having really, we weren't raised very strictly, but there was always a little element of, you know, respecting the culture at the very least. So,
right.
My wife is more about the idea of, like, setting some structure, religious structure for them in order to, like, kind of teach morals and things through, like, Bible and things like that, and then let them make their own decision when they're old enough to know the difference. Mm-hmm. To me, I feel really kind of weird about that because I truly believe that, like, it's important for people to know the culture of your background. And for my wife, I feel like it's Cuban because of all the struggles and persecution and all the things her family had to deal with and escaped and dealt with. And for me, it's Judaism, which to me is more of a culture than a religion in many ways.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain that to people who aren't Jewish.
Yes.
I'm sure you can relate.
Yes.
But yeah, you can. The thing is about Judaism, and something I'm very proud of, is that it's like the only religion that you can consider yourself Jewish and still not really believe in God.
Like, yeah. No, like, it's true.
Like, it's not synonymous. Like,
Also not the rules that are there. It's like, if you want to do this, then you have to say this and have to do this. It's a little more, it's a little more gray area there with the Old Testament, right?
It is, and it is cultural because, I mean, there's diseases that Jewish people get, like, you know, like African Americans might get sickle cell or whatever. Like, there's certain things that are
bred, Tay-Sachs,
and there's, like, you know, there's cultural things, and there's the reality of whether you're religious or not. You know, you would have been in a concentration camp just based on your background and your So, I mean, like, there is some element of, like, it is cultural, even if you're not this really that strict about the religious and the Bible study stuff, right?
Sure.
So it's a tough one. So yeah, I feel you, man.
Okay. Let me ask you this. This is an unpopular opinion that comes up all the time when someone's like, "Oh, you know, you're a white." I'm like, "I'm not white."
Yeah.
Like, don't call me white.
Like, I know. That, I know.
Like,
how
do you actually feel about that? Because I'm like, I know it's an unpopular thing to say, and it makes no sense to people.
Well, here's how I say it, because, like, this is, you know, it's like, it's so funny because my wife and I both were married previously and had bad marriages with kind of dysfunctional things in both our
families. Brad, why don't you sit this one out, by the way, all right?
Yeah, so I don't want to offend anyone. You know? I don't offend anyone. But, you know, there's not wrong or right about this, but there is difference, you know? And I just think in general, I try to describe it as, like, cultural, ethnic and cultural kind of, like, families have a different kind of value system sometimes, just inbred. Yeah. And so,
as opposed to what, though, like, just your standard, like, white Christian kind of power structure?
I think that, like, many, many generations of American culture, you know, is a little less old school, right? So it's a little less, family values. It's a little less, like, you know, you get married, you make it work. It's kind of like, you know.
Yeah.
There's been 7 divorces in my family. It's kind of normal. You know, it's
I'm supposed
just a
to
different,
get divorced,
it's not wrong or right. It's just like a little bit of a different, situation, you know? And, so it's like, I don't know. I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying.
I mean, it's the thing is, like, I don't know if I'm white or not. It's not like my, you know, it's not really my place to say either way. Like, I don't fucking know. All I know is that I'm not what people consider white. And I know I'm not that.
I mean, that's where there's that thing
that like every Jewish person has to wake up and realize at some point is like you wake up one day and you realize that there are a large group of people in the world who want you hurt or dead simply because of what you are.
That's true, but you also don't wear it like, you know.
Of course not.
There's a reason why the Jews in the Holocaust had to wear a star on them. Because yes. they like everybody else, you know, and so
we still get the white privilege, like opt out option if we want it. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
You know,
so maybe not culturally. Well, maybe culturally white, but genetically not. I don't know.
I mean, it's a tricky question, man.
But I've had a lot of fun over the years just telling white people I'm not white anyway. I just enjoy what it does to the room, you know, even more than like how I feel.
Yeah, I'm sure that doesn't go over very well with a bunch of black guys. who've been discriminated against by police and all kinds of stuff, you know. I'm sure
now I'll call myself a white guy because in typical white guy fashion, I've never done that around a group of black guys.
Well, so. There you go.
So maybe, yeah, I guess I'm white. Shit, man.
You're totally sucks. White, bro.
I don't like this, Ben. I thought you were going to take me the other way.
You are a white boy.
Sorry, Betty.
Brad, now I'm like you.
I've never
moved to Iowa together or something. What happens Brad's now?
Like, Brad's like, what the hell is going on right now?
He's like, what are these? What are these?
I didn't sign up for this.
So, yeah, what is this? What are you speaking right now? I wanted to talk about the way you like went into like business on the business side of music, like, you know, from a pretty early point you were, you know, interested in self-releasing, self-promotion, trying to own your own publishing, you know, from the get of Dillinger and, you know, your early bands, did you like sense something was wrong with the model? Did you hate the model? Like, why do you think you had a sort of different way of looking at that early on, especially?
Well, I mean, it was, well, part of it's just coming from the underground hardcore culture, you know,
right.
It's like the do it yourself thing by necessity. And obviously I had an entrepreneurial bug in me, you know, but, you know, at the same time, look, I guess, you know, there wasn't a huge business upside in anyone getting involved in a band like Dillinger. Let's be real.
Yes,
you know,
at the time, especially. Yeah, for sure.
It didn't seem, you know, there wasn't really a, it didn't seem like a type of band that would generate income or money, real money for someone to commission. So like, you know, having real lawyers and real management and all that stuff really wasn't an option, even if we wanted it.
Gotcha.
Kind of educating yourself, and somebody in the band had to do it. And the ones that didn't do well. And there were a lot of bands out there that I knew, that we knew, that didn't have that guy in the band. Yeah. And, you know, they sunk because they just said, I don't know, I just want to play music. I don't care, whatever you think, to some manager or some major label that scooped them up for like a record and then they got dropped. Or, you know, they didn't ask questions, they didn't care. They just wanted to rock, and there's nothing wrong with that, but they typically didn't do very well in my experience, you know,
yeah,
from what I saw. They didn't survive.
Right.
You know.
And you saw like bands you were friends with and people like that kind of go through that early on.
Yeah. I mean, look, there was, you know, I mean, I can say an example of, and I mean this with all respect because I fucking get it, you know? You know, like that band Cave-In, you know, those guys.
Sure.
We came up together. We were playing tours. It was like Botch, Dillinger, Cave-In, Converge. We would all play shows together. And
great fucking
even
scene,
though we all had slightly different takes on things, you know, there was a tie that bound us and
for sure.
And across our fan base, and we all pushed each other and enjoyed each other's company and music. And then, you know, Cave-In got signed to a major label and took on a big manager.
All right.
And just kind of like, really just did whatever she said. She's like, they're like, whatever you say, like, we just want to make music. We don't want to deal with stuff. Understandably, fair enough. And, you know, I saw a lot of decisions being made, like spend your a big advance on getting a whole shit ton of cases with cave-in silkscreened on them, you know, like, for all of your gear and like, spend, like take more crew members than you ever needed before for whatever reason. And, you know, cancel the botched Dillinger tour and headline big rooms to look like a big rock band. And then, you know, and kind of like alienate your current fan base before even acquiring a new one, you know?
Yes.
And those are all things that, in all fairness, they were just kind of like, look, we just want to make music. We don't want to do that stuff. That's not what we do. That's not what we signed up for. Let someone else do it. And that totally makes sense. But
and theirs was coupled with kind of that true belief that they could break, though. You know, they had a, you know, they had a different sound than you guys. And I think they... they like were under the impression that if we put out this major label record with a poppy enough choruses and stuff, we can actually break into like a modern rock kind of world.
Right. And maybe they could have. I mean, look at Jimmy Eat World.
Yeah, sure.
You know, they were like a small and like indie kind of like whatever, hard, you know.
I saw them at Coney Island High with a Sensefield.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
And Mineral.
Yeah.
Who I don't know if you've listened to Mineral in a while. It doesn't hold up.
Okay, I haven't.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's true because what you're saying is breaking, even if they'd broken, though, that just means they're going to lose more money. They're going to lose larger amounts of money.
Yeah,
whereas
if
you don't break, you break up, right? Because you make a lot of bad decisions. But I know, I know people who have, you know, who have made it, and what that means is that just more people are taking and wasting more of their money.
Often,
I mean, it's the same. It was the same lesson that was drilled into me as a young man. That like learn the business, and I completely ignored it, and we were all punk rock, and like you know, and any band at any level, and pretty much in any era, really does need to. They need to take care of their own business, you know. Like we were lawyered up, and we had the staff.
At least gotta know what the fuck is going on.
At least educate yourself.
It should be like mandatory, like band 101. You know, like basic business.
Make sure someone from the band is always CC'd on the email. You know,
bands for dummies. Yeah. Has anybody written that yet?
I don't know, Ben.
Was it bands for? For dummies?
Bands for dummies? What do you think, Ben? This could be...
I mean, look, I think, you know, a friend of mine, Jesse Cannon, I know I'm familiar with him. He wrote really pretty in-depth DIY book kind of guy.
What was his book called?
I wrote the foreword to it. I should know.
Oh, no shit. I didn't know Jesse wrote
something
a book.
About
That's cool. Yeah.
Fuck. It's DIY. Hold on. I got it. Like, actually, tell you. It is. Get More Fans DIY Guide to. It's the Get More Fans, the DIY Guide to New Music.
Cool. Jesse Cannon, old New Jersey stalwart.
That's right. So, I mean, look, I think to answer your question, like, we didn't really have a choice. Someone had to do it.
Yeah.
And. Truthfully, a lot of mistakes were made, and luckily we got through them in order to hopefully learn from them. And
well, that being said, like, what's something you wish you could tell yourself when you first started with like your years of accrued knowledge? Like, say you can go say what's up to Ben from Arcane and you could just drop like a couple things on him, like, yo, make sure you do this and don't do this. Like, what's something you could tell him?
All right. Well, I'll tell you, there's a whole bunch, man. I can tell you a whole shit ton. A couple are, look, I think number one, no decision's going to make you or break you. Like, you know, like sometimes it's better to make the wrong decision than no decision. Okay. There were so many times I like just was so controlling and so concerned with being taken advantage of that, like I said no to so many things, merch deals and this and that, whatever, that I, you know, I'd rather just keep my hands on it and get nothing done than take the chance of getting ripped off or not getting the best deal or whatever. And I would have definitely you know, been a little more quicker to make decisions and make moves, and just do your best and make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of holding out, looking for the best, you know, moment to happen. I think, there's another thing, you know, like, and you probably know this, and I'm sure both of you can relate to this being in bands and stuff. And, I know Gaslight Anthem is probably really relevant, but like, we fought the mathcore title for years, forever.
Right.
Like,
sure.
People were like, this is mathcore. Like, and there really didn't exist. I mean, there was like math rock and stuff like that. And
yeah.
There was like math metal, I guess, kind of like Meshuggah, but mathcore was pretty much us. We started that, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
We didn't intentionally, but that's right. What people called it, because there wasn't a label and everything had to be labeled. Right. And of course, where it was like, we're not anything. We're just a rock and roll band. You know how like bands always said that? Like,
yeah. Uh-huh.
We're rock and roll. We're just a rock and roll band, you know, whatever. Call it what you want. We're just rock and roll. We're a punk rock band. No, we were a fucking mathcore band. Like,
yeah.
And if I could go back, as soon as people started labeling us as mathcore, I would put mathcore on every single thing we ever did.
Right.
Every single thing, because
to you make know, sure when, you were branded as like the kings of mathcore?
As much as like it's corny to be like, we're a mathcore band, like when we felt like we were just like, you know, some like avant-garde heavy band. Like, sure. That was marketing. That was not a good marketing move, because like the truth is, it's like, hey, if someone says you're mathcore, make sure that anytime ever that word ever comes up ever, you're the first thing that shows up.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You're the mathcore.
Because you can't avoid it anyway. So make sure, just make sure that you just own it. So that's something I would change, not being too pretentious to just be like, yeah, well, sure, mathcore,
right.
Fine.
Sure,
done.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I mean, it's funny. I mean, it's hard to do at the time, you know, when you're inside of it, you're so in love with what you're doing. You're so emotionally invested. It's almost like, you're like blinded by love, you know, you're making emotional decisions rather than rational ones. Yeah,
of course. So that's a big one. I mean, look, I think another thing that, that I learned kind of by hook or by crook, and I would have owned a little earlier, was that it's more important for you to be honest with what you do and like consistent than it is to like worry about what other people think even. So like,
sure.
For instance, like, you know, and that's what basically we did, and that's what we're kind of known for, luckily.
Yeah.
But truthfully, you know, if you're honest about what you do and you do it for the right reasons and you always do it for the right reasons, then people will follow you into the fire. It doesn't matter what kind of music you make, if you add melodic content to your heavy band, if you go on tour with a band that's not cool, if you like, those things are less important than just being super true and honest to your art, because once people know that what you're creating is honest and you're doing it for the right reasons, then like they just trust you. Whatever decision you make, whatever you do, they just trust you. That's it.
No, you're right. You can't, they don't want to be lied to.
Right.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you even brought it up, and Cave-In's a good example. I always felt if Cave-In didn't reject their old catalog, you know, and if they were just like, yeah, we love Until Your Heart Stops, we love those records, we'll still play you some songs every once in a while, but this is what we do now, you know, if you're along for the vibe. But it was kind of a total, like, I turn my back and this is what we do now, you know? I felt like Against Me had a similar issue too, because, you know, it made total sense that they signed to a major when they did, but spent so many years saying that you wouldn't sign to a major and kind of talking bad about it, that when it happened, you know, you set yourself up for a fall.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's totally good advice. Very good advice.
Yeah, I think, like you said, I think it probably would have been more important for them to not say they'll never sign to a major and just continue to do things for the right reasons and do them right and make, you know.
For sure.
And then whatever they did, you know, it's like once people believe in your, like, brand, they'll just buy whatever you do, you know, and that's the ultimate way to survive as a musician is like be able to sell anything because they believe in you, you know?
Yeah, they believe in you. That's right. The thing. So it's like, yeah, you can never fuck with that trust. That's the
totally.
Thing.
So instead of bitching about album sales not selling or this or that, whatever, it doesn't fucking matter if they believe in what you're doing and they're like, these guys, I trust them. I trust them. Then you can put out a shirt. You can do whatever the hell you release. It could be a fucking.
So you can always do a tour in Germany and Austria, you know?
It doesn't matter.
They'll always be there for you.
Yeah. Nobody cares what Apple puts out. They just bought it because they believe in Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't have to be a computer. It didn't have to be an iPad or a deep flea player. It doesn't matter. People wait in line for it, even if it's not as good as the fucking Microsoft version or the Dell. Right, it doesn't matter. People just believe. They just believe in it and they buy it. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And the four bands just took that on, that kind of, you know, philosophy.
Sure. And that's still kind of the model you're doing, right? Because, I mean, you have a Patreon page, right, where you – have a paywall and offer content, and I have to assume like a lion's share of these people are Dillinger fans.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
So how do you find like kind of the post Dillinger scenario for you and like the Patreon and things like that? Like, how's that working for you and do you enjoy it?
I love it. I mean, I like being able to create without the pressure of a label or anything like that. I like the fact that people are buying my music, but they also know that it's helping a good cause.
Yes, yes.
There's something about that that's, I don't know, like you know, the question, everyone's like, are you guys a nonprofit? Are you guys a 501c so that we can just donate to you? And the truth is, no, we're not. And are we going to become one? I don't think so. Why? Because, you know, while we can't write off all the money that I get from Patreon as a tax deduction, it's all under my terms. Like, you know, like nobody can tell me you have 1 foot less of land than you're supposed to have to run a nonprofit animal sanctuary and you're getting shut down. They're like, no, these are my pets. This is my place. I take good care of them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Stay out of my business. And often when you try and do things like that, it becomes much more complicated. And that's what I'm learning too from my friends who have sanctuaries who are like legit animal lovers, vegans, put all their lives into it. It's almost like the more you publicize it and make it a mission like that, the more people mess with you, especially animal people, you know? So to me, it's like, this is my home. This is a sanctuary. This is a place where animals come. They're never eaten. They're never used for anything. They just live their lives and hopefully well. And we enjoy the peace and solitude we get from them. It's like our sanctuary more than anything, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that I can now have a reason to create music in order to support this is just great, you know? So needing to raise money to support this and having to do it through making music is just like kind of a win-win, you know? It keeps me active, keeps me creative.
It's pretty awesome. So the video, I love the track It Is Nothing that you put out. Super cool.
Thank you.
And the video, I found myself watching it fairly late last night and pretty fucking tripped out. Did you make the video?
No. Okay. A longtime collaborator, Oleg Ruse. Who did a bunch of Dillinger content and came on the road with Dillinger. And then I brought him out with Suicidal as well.
Okay.
To just do live content. He's from the Ukraine and, he's just like a badass hardworking kid. And like, you know, he was doing so much with so little and I was so into that,
that's awesome.
Kind of attitude of like, look, you don't need the most expensive gear to make something happen. I mean, none of us had it when we started, right?
No, like, certainly not.
Yeah, you're not. I'm sure you were playing on pots and pans and you're still making music. So
well,
it's like,
I lived in an apartment with my mom, so I would have band practice where, you know, my drums would live at my guitar player's house.
Right.
And then I would come home and set up like a pillow kit.
Totally.
And like practice our songs and stuff to get ready for shows. Yeah. So
there you go. You know, it's like make it happen, right? So,
yeah.
this kid has been doing that. And so I work with him as much as possible. And he made that for me.
Because I saw it, I was like, you know, I think people could very much imagine Ben like in his basement stoned making this video, but you don't get stoned. So I was watching it and I'm like, man, how do these straight edge guys, how do they just get so trippy sometimes? So, one of my best friends, Daryl Coco, listens to the stoniest, slowest, drudgiest music I know, like stuff that puts me to sleep in 2.5 minutes. He's stone sober listening to these records for like 80 minutes. I have no concept of how he even does it. So how much, like, I know you never really like X'd up and identified with straight edge, but you know, I know you still are. And does, you know, like, were you ever really taken into that movement? Does it mean a lot to you still? Do you like to, do you like people to know that you don't, you know, use drugs and stuff?
Right. So, I'm definitely not straight edge. I mean, like, it's interesting because as I got older and got more in the business and started, it became difficult. The fact is that not drinking and things like that became a, like an obstacle for me because, you know, you're trying to hang out with industry people. You're trying to get things done. I'm managing artists. And like, if you're not sharing a drink with them, they don't trust you. It's like, you know, so that never encouraged me to do it. But, like I said, like if somebody was like, take a drink of this, I'll be like, sure. And I'll be like, yep, still don't like it. You know what I mean?
right.
Like, it's like, the point is like, it's not me just trying to have some kind of elitist thing. Like, do what you want to do, do what's good for you. It's just not for me, you know? And the truth is I've tried smoking weed. I've tried drinking a little bit with my family and at holidays and stuff now. And that's still just not for me. It's still not for me. You know, I don't get anything out of it. And I know plenty of people who are extremely functional, who smoke and are extremely functional and even more focused and do well in it. I know people who are the exact opposite. I don't think it's a one size fits all situation at all. Like for me, it's always been about the output, you know? So
If
someone's inspiring me and is doing something amazing, how they got there is not important to me. Like if they do drugs, if they don't do drugs, it's like, it's not important. What's important to me is if what they're making is inspiring and special to me. So
whatever people need to use to,
that's not my business. Yeah. It's not my business. And, I find people judging me way more than I've judged anyone else. You know,
I could see that. Did you have much of an issue on with touring? I know, especially in your world, like, I know metal guys can fucking throw down hard.
For sure.
Like, did you ever find it isolating on tour? And like, what did you do to basically entertain yourself while the party's getting wild?
Yeah, you know, I did feel like discriminated against a little bit and left out often. People assumed I wouldn't want to be invited out or hang out just because I don't drink, and that sometimes was sucked.
Or you were you designated driver quite a bit?
You know, in the early days when we were doing vans, nobody drank actually.
Oh, okay. So, oh, good.
You know, it wasn't till later we were kind of in tour buses and doing that kind of thing that everyone started partying and stuff like that. So interestingly enough, again, like I feel like I was discriminated against a little more than I would ever judge anyone else just for not doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in that respect, yeah, definitely, could have been sometimes a little bit lonely.
Yeah, it's strange. People don't know what to do with it. They're like, you have a drink? There's a funny John Mulaney skit about that where people don't know what to do with people who don't drink at parties. Like, you want like just some turnip juice or something? Is that good for you?
Yeah.
I've seen it too because, you know, Brian didn't really party all those years through Gaslight. And yeah, you know, I see it. But also, I'm so thankful for it, you know, later in life because if he was doing what we were doing, I don't know, like you said, I don't know if our output is as strong. I don't know if we're as focused, you know, kind of eye on the prize. So in the long run, I'm actually quite thankful for that. So I heard in one interview, you said that you don't think you could do something as important ever again as like Dillinger at their peak. Do you think that like you know, Dillinger, all bands. Do you think bands have a wave? Like they have a special period of time where all the stars kind of align and then you basically have to put as much output out in that time and then that time never comes again? Do you think that's a thing?
I mean, I think there's something magical about a time when there's no expectations, you know, when you're making a band without a fan base, because nobody's like worrying about being a sellout or not living up to their last release or, yeah, I think there's something magical about that for sure. And there's certainly such thing as sophomoritis where a second album suffers because the band is more convinced they're untouchable because of their critical acclaim.
Right.
Then, and also the fact that they've probably been touring much more than they've been writing and being creative, which sure. is just a natural thing. Like, there's definitely an obstacle there, I think, that many artists suffer from, you know?
Okay.
But, yeah, there is a magic to that, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's not a definite thing. What do you think?
I mean, kind of, you know, like I think if you're, you know, I think if a band has that kind of run, you know, like a band like Dillinger, I could say a band like Gaslight too, had just a run of time where what you were doing just naturally just connected with people and the music. And like that part of it was easy. It was almost like, here's the creation. We're confident about it. People are stoked on it. And it's just this sort of natural run where certain pretenses aren't there, certain expectations aren't there. Like you said, I do think it's possible to sustain as long as like you're not attempting to do that again. Like you talked about earlier, if you're honest with your fans, you're honest with yourself and the music you actually want to make, and you're presenting it as such, I think you could catch another run of lightning. But you're not going to catch the same lightning, you know, like no matter how hard you try, you're not going to write Calculating Infinity again.
Right.
Why should you, you know?
Sure.
And I think that's where people run into problems with sustaining is, you know, and, you know, we both know it, like you get in these, you know, you start to, before you know it, you have no expectation of it. And then you're paying things from it.
Right.
And all of a sudden other things have expectation from it. You know what I mean? And it's like, oh, this is that now. And it, you know, and to have that kind of awareness and that clarity, like when you're inside of it is maybe nearly impossible, especially with the age that most people probably hit it, you know?
Right. For sure.
See, I do. I think you were right in saying that for sure.
Interesting. Yeah.
So we got to talk about you breaking your entire body at least like once. So, you know, I remember the first time I saw you really, really go after someone was at Matt Levitin's benefit show at Manville Elks.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I remember we, you know, it was the first time we had set up sort of a significant stage on the other side of the room. Uh-huh. And, you know, of course, me and like 11 other local drummers are all on stage staring at Chris, wondering what the fuck he is doing.
As they did, yeah.
Yeah, at the time, we're just all watching like, okay. Yeah, I guess that happens now.
Right.
Yeah, but like I remember, you know, that was the first time I saw you kind of run out, you know, stab someone in the stomach with your headstock. And, you know, at the time, the only bands I'd seen, you know, I'd seen Botch use some lights, which, you know, was intense. I'd seen Dead Guy kind of go nuts, but never really like, you know, get physical with the audience like that.
Right.
Like what was the impetus at the beginning? Like how did that even start, man?
I mean, that's a good question. You know, that has been a, no, I actually found a little notebook of a little journal I was writing on the road recently, and I had written something about we had played a show in Chicago, and actually Mastodon was opening up for us at the time.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, and at the end of the show, I threw my guitar. I was so pumped. It was a sold out show. It's a big place. I was just hyped. And at the end of the show, I took my guitar and just bashed it out of just pure, just, I don't know, emotional energy. I just took my guitar and bashed
good emotion, good emotional energy.
Yeah, it was, yeah, I was okay. Just fucking fired up, man.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Bashed my guitar and decided it would be cool if I threw it over the crowd and finished exploding it on the back wall of the club. Like somehow, I don't know how I thought this was a good idea or if I thought at all, but like, right. It's just, and I, and it was a big, you know, it was a decent play size play. So it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't that likely it was going to make it, you know,
right.
actually. And, we had also just released this EP with Mike Patton.
Yes.
And so
yes.
There was a whole new group of people coming to our shows that were not, and that was a big part of like the elevation of our size clubs and things like that. Like
right, sure.
Being exposed to the Mike Patton crowd all of a sudden, you know, kind of brought us, made us bigger than the band we were when we were touring with like Cave-In and Conversion and
right.
That stuff. All of a sudden,
but the Faith No More audience has never seen.
Yeah, all of a,
someone
right,
do
all of a sudden we had
shows,
like a Faith
yeah.
No More or Bungle. Like, yeah, like so there was now this mix of like girls that would have never been there who are Patton fans and.
Right.
You know, like just, yeah, like you said, like a Faith No More crowd or fanatics of Patton that had never been in a VFW hall, like with no stage
right.
to
right, right.
And looking out for mosh pits and stuff like that. So, I remember that, I guess I threw my brass, my guitar, I chucked it. I went downstairs. I was just pacing all pumped. And our tour manager, kind of manager, best friend, sixth member, Tom,
right. Yeah.
Obviously, you might remember.
Sure.
Walks downstairs and goes, "I think we just killed somebody." And it was nice enough to say "we" when really, it was me. You know what I mean? Not really. Yeah. That just showed how
solidarity
like,
yeah.
he was. You know, sure. Like it's like you know we're all in this together.
Yeah, yeah. Good for him.
You know, so I think we just killed someone, and I'm like, "What?" He's like, "There's a girl laying in a pile of blood out there," and so I. I was like, oh my God. And I run out there and I see her laying there and the club people are around her and her two dude friends that are with her are staring at me like they're going to murder me.
Yeah.
You know? Right. And I'm just like, oh my God, I'm sorry. I never meant that. I didn't mean that, blah, blah, blah. And she's like super scared because she's laying, you know, her head, she has a head injury. She's laying down. There's a lot of blood. And she's like, "There is one thing you can do," as she's like in tears. "Can you introduce me to Mike Patton?" And I said, "I mean, I can try, but I said in the meantime, like we got to help you. You know what's going on." And so anyway, she paramedics took her away and this and that. And I could not sleep, man. I was like laying up all night. I was like, "Is this why I started this band?" Like to fucking hurt people?
Yeah, right.
You know, but at the same time, when I don't do that, people want their fucking money back. They're like, "That's not the Dillinger I know."
Yeah,
you
right.
You know what
right.
I mean? And I found myself in this conflict of like where it started as this kind of free, uninhibited form of expression when you're playing in front of three people don't give a shit about you.
Yeah.
As like a venting thing in between, you know, on the weekends after class or work or something, turned into a career of like people expecting you to be violent and stuff like that. But at the same time,
right.
Like putting you in this position where people are getting hurt and that wasn't the intention of your band.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. It's like so, watching that 60-year-old drummer from the Murder Junkies like stick a drumstick up his ass still.
Yeah. I mean, well, I don't know what his intention was, but
well, the same thing. He's like, "I think people will expect this now, so I better put a stick up my ass every show."
Yeah, I need to put sticks up my ass now. Yeah.
So what did you find in that journal that was like that
well,
was illuminating?
I had written a whole thing about like how I never intended to do this to hurt people, you know,
right,
but at the same time, it's become synonymous with Dillinger, you know, like the violence, the in your face, the inclusiveness, the like I said, free, uninhibited expression between you and the crowd and like the feeling of danger and unpredictability that really, I think, you know, all of us who had like you and me and like both you guys that had grown up hearing stories about the first days of punk rock and hardcore and the danger and the unpredictability is like we all kind of missed out on, and we felt like we didn't get that. By the time we started doing it, everyone was just preaching about politics or Krishna or religion. Yeah. Nobody was actually seeing something that had never happened before.
Sure.
So that's really what Dillinger was about for me. And
it's interesting.
But it turned into people getting hurt. And
including yourself,
including myself. But it was, I didn't care about myself. I cared about these people who just, you know, the few people that were there and who didn't want that, or like, it was very conflicting for me. It was very conflicting. I wanted to just quit the band. I didn't know what to do. I'd written about like how, you know, being successful has been a burden and the expectations, have created a scenario where like you can only go down, you know?
Right.
Like, and was it interesting?
Was it kind of nice? Like when Greg came in, did you ever feel like, oh, I don't have to do something at this show because Greg's going to do something? Or did you guys just like kind of ramp each other up?
Oh, we definitely ramped each other up. Yeah,
he's quite the athlete, you know?
Yeah, we definitely ramped each other up. I think I will tell you a story about Greg when he first joined the band. It was like his first real U.S. tour with us. And, you know, he was still kind of not really – he hadn't hurt himself. He hadn't – you know what I mean? He hadn't really – been in danger himself, you know. He was still in the stage of like, I'm the front man, I got the mic, people move out of the way, you know.
Right Dillinger rookie.
Right, totally. Yeah. And we were in Las Vegas actually playing this like hall, and right before we went on, he goes, one of these days you're gonna knock my fucking teeth out. Literally. And then we kick into the first song, which was the Mullet Burden, and I zig, he zags, I turn around and swing my guitar. He turns around. Like, literally, we just turned into each other, smacked his teeth, cut, broke his tooth in half.
Oh.
Literally. And whole mouth is bleeding. His lip is ripped. Shit. Blood everywhere. And
called it.
Yeah, dude. It was like, what? So the song ends like right after that happens, and he turns around and he's holding his face and he's shaking, like totally scared. At this point, he didn't realize he's not made of glass yet. I had already realized that. Like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, I hurt myself every fucking day and life goes on. You know, he still hadn't realized that. There's only people, like two people who end up realizing that, people in Dillinger and fighters, you know, like, you know, like you can get a black eye, you can knock your teeth, you can cut your head open, you can get a concussion, and you can, you're not dead, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, you still play tomorrow. Yeah.
You gotta go on, right? Yeah. So, and he still hadn't experienced that yet. And so, you know, sure, he lifted a lot of weights, but he had never, you know, been a UFC fighter or had never been in a band like Dillinger, you know? So,
yeah, sure.
He looked at me, he turned around, he looked at me, we were both facing the drums, and he's holding his mouth and looking at his handful of blood and shaking. He's like, what do I do? Oh my God, the show's over. Oh my God, what do I do? What do I do? And I was like, Greg, you shut the fuck up. You turn around and you finish this fucking show. And I saw his face kind of change. Like, dude, Ben Wyman just fucking, like, just it just showed me, like, he just fucking told me what's up.
Yeah.
And I need to fucking stop being a pussy right now. And he, like, I saw his face change. I saw it go from scared to like, I'm a fucking warrior. Like, I'm a goddamn, like, this is some shit. This is like, I am Braveheart right now. You know what I mean? Like, this is fucking rad. This crowd is going to see a dude covered in blood, and it's going to be rad, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he went from shaking to like he took his hand and started rubbing the blood all over his face and his shirt, and he turned around and looked horrifying and fucking gave the best show of his life.
And that's when, you know, Greg was born, the new and Greg.
Literally,
was born.
No, that was the day he was real. He was Dillinger's gay boy.
That's fucking that awesome. Ben, there couldn't be a better place than that to finish, I think.
Yeah,
that's great, man. Well, I wanted to just add, just to finish, you know, usually I've been starting the interviews with this, but like, you know, we are in a quarantine, and all this shit is going on.
Sure.
Is there anything, you know, you're using on a day-to-day basis to kind of keep your head around this in a good way? And, you know, I know your wife's kind of in the line of fire. So how you doing with all this? And you got anything to say to the people out there who might be struggling with it?
Man, you know, it's tough. I think that there's a lot of questions about what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing, what the best way forward is, what to believe, what information is accurate and what isn't. But ultimately, I think the one thing we can get out of this is that for once, this world is all kind of like in one place and we all have something in common. And in general, I think one way or another, we're all going to get through this and learn a lot from it. So I think I really appreciate all the people that are making the best of it, who are trying to stay positive, who are doing things like you guys, doing these podcasts and talking to people and staying creative. And I just am super pumped on all the creative people out there that are helping everyone get through this by creating content and reaching out and making songs and doing podcasts. I think that's rad. So thank you guys for doing it.
Well, thank you, Ben. Yeah. And thanks for doing everything you do, making great music, being a good person, and taking care of all them animals. You're a good man. I look forward to seeing you again.
Good speaking with you guys.
Ah, good interview, Ben. Smart guy.
You know, funny story. I'll keep it brief, but my brother was a brewmaster for a while.
Okay.
And he was kind of a sweat equity partner with these two guys who had put up the money. And one of the guys decided, like, let's put in a petting zoo at the brewery. So when people come for tours, they can take their kids out back. And this guy just really wanted to have a bunch of animals.
Yeah.
That wasn't like a business decision to draw people. He wanted an excuse to take more of the company money and put it into animals.
And the last thing I want to do when I'm letting people pet animals is get drunk.
Yeah.
You know, that's when they just get the worst. It's like a bunch of 6-year-olds mismanaging animals, you know?
Anyway. Ugh. But yeah.
Feel bad for that goat.
I was thinking about that the whole interview. Was the the brew petting zoo.
Well, Ben is pretty cool. I've really had a lot of respect. I know he wouldn't give himself too many compliments in the interview, but I have always really respected the way that he went about his business. You know, outside C companies to do distribution and things like that. If you have the avenue to own your masters and you have the avenue to self-record and license and self-release and do other things, like, it's really smart to do it, especially coming into the streaming age when literally the only capital at this point is the ownership of the masters.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, he's a little ahead of his time in that way and people should take a cue from it. And I also think his path after Dillinger Escape Plan, you know, setting up this Patreon account, being very connected with his fans, taking money directly to, you know, fund the songs he's doing, and not only that, but to fund the animal sanctuary itself. And you're finding a really interesting way to keep something independent and keep something his. And also, again, which is probably going to be sort of the preliminary roadmap for the future of how bands are going to monetize themselves independently because of the loss of physical music and the fact that we're never going to get paid a good amount from streams. So I think there's a lot to learn about that. And I think we learned a little something, didn't we? Cause is there a Patreon in our future, Brad?
Oh yeah. We're going to launch it this week. I promise. I've been saying that, but I've got the content together. I've got the ideas. So, if you want to support us, and I just want to also thank everybody who's been giving us Venmo cash. That's amazing. And it's being used for sure. And but we have had sort of a clamoring for Patreon. So I am not going to argue with you if you want to give us money. Patreon.com/ Going Off Track, and it should be up this week. I don't know if it'll be up by the time you hear this, but we are going to get it up this week, and we'll have two tiers. Hopefully they'll be affordable. We'll have some bonus content on there. We're going to eventually start doing like some mini pods just for the Patreon. But we'll try and do some video. But there'll be a bunch of stuff. Go to the page, check it out. If you can give, that's great. If not, you can always throw us a tip on Venmo and, you know, give us reviews on iTunes and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. We need more followers. Going Off Track, Instagram and Twitter. That's my spiel.
Need that social capital, baby.
Yeah, we need it.
No, I really do. I appreciate anybody who wants to fund the show. As you've noticed, you know, we're not funded by anybody else. We're not part of a podcast network. We've run very minimal ads. If you want to support, it'll go a long way. And if you also have any ideas for, you know, what cool extra content or a chat or something like that that actually makes this stuff worthwhile, you know, throw a message our way. We're not the masters. We're a couple old men trying to get our finger on the pulse here. So if you have, you know, some better ideas than us, we're always welcome to hear them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So thanks for that. Thanks, Ben. We got some socials. He's Ben Wyman on Instagram. His manager page is at Party Smasher Inc. And then on Twitter, he's not on, but Dillinger Escape Plan still has a Twitter. It's all caps, TDEP _. I know, you know, sometimes the Going Off Track audience might not be a metal or, you know, a heavy music audience. I have no idea, honestly. But if you haven't checked out Dillinger and if you haven't really gotten into it, I mean, it's a ride, man. And that band brought things to another fucking level.
Yeah, I'm hardcore not and metal. By any means a math rock guy or mathcore or anything with the word math in it.
Right.
But I like Dillinger. They're like the only band that has been branded with that term that I would listen to. I don't find their timings to be obnoxious, put it that way.
Yeah, I just don't even know what they are. That's why I like Dillinger. I just listen to it, and it's like watching a 3-hour long movie. I'm just like, you know what? I have no idea how they put this together, but I'm lost, and I don't want to know. But I appreciate it so much. And especially their early records with Chris Penny on drums.
Right.
I literally saw that guy do a drum clinic playing parts of Calculating Infinity slower than they are on the record, so you can actually see what the fuck he's doing.
Oh, really?
And I'm like, you're at half speed and I still can't do this. I don't even know what it is you're doing. And when I was joking with Ben, you know, I remember specifically at the Manville Elks benefit show in, you know, early 96, they played, and I, you know, was on stage. It was my show, so I got to go on stage, and I'm planted up behind Chris Penny, just like, all right, I'm going to watch him drum. And I looked to my left and my right, and there's just like 11 local drummers just like sitting in the back by the monitors.
Taking notes.
Just like with this confused look on our face, just like, goodness gracious. All right. We all got to do more because this is putting us in a bad box.
Right.
You know, I could barely do a triplet then. Fuck.
Yeah.
But yeah. So thanks to Chris for getting me better at my flams.
Nice.
And thanks to Ben for coming on. I'll be going there every year to feed his goats a Christmas tree.
Sweet.
And hopefully we can reassess. But thanks to everyone. Appreciate it. And next week's guest. Golden.
Yeah. Classic. It's going to be classic.
Classic. All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.